welcome. It's This Is Going Well, I Think, and 1, 2, 3. Show where no one's listening, no one cares, the show where every episode's the last episode, and well, I'm David Cooper. I know I said I'd be back sooner, but my trip to Canada was phenomenal. Thank you for asking. You didn't ask? Well, let's get on with this show. Today, cat pee with science expert Daniel K. Riskin. The story, kind of interesting. It has long puzzled scientists why cat spray against a wall smells so damn bad, but cat pee in your cat's box only smells a little bit bad. The thinking was there was two kinds of pee, but it turns out it's the same pee. Yet one smells different. This is my kind of story, and we'll find out why with Dan Riskin. After that, it's the obligatory coverage on why TikTok was banned by U.S. Congress, how the ban works, when's it going to take effect, and will it actually stop China from potentially spreading propaganda in the U.S.? We'll find out with Carmi Levy. And finally, it's spooky, scary ghosts with ghost guide Daniel. Daniel will answer the question, can ghosts make us sick? Ooh, spooky, scary, and will I confront him about whether ghosts are real? I probably will. It is going to be an action-packed show, and you have all of that to look forward to. But before all that, we're going to catch up with the very British Tony Five, who sent a voice note from a cruise ship that he's on in a little segment we call The Seaman's Alive with Tony Five. Wednesday, April the 24th.
So, welcome to day one of Tony Five live on a cruise. It's 15:14, or 3:14 as we say here in the Mediterranean. I am in Rome and a place called Civita Vecchia. I'm outside, David. The water's wet. So are the girls. Life is good, my friend. A lot of Americans, very fat. A lot of Canadians, very odd. A lot of English people, very stiff. I've already seen my targets. There's a couple of ducks around. There's a big buffet, David. This is Tony Five, live, reporting from a ship somewhere in the Mediterranean.
Day two, Thursday, April the 25th.
David, day two at sea. I'm in Italy near a place called Carbonara. Very good, very blue outside. Didn't feel any of the waves overnight, didn't lose my stroke at all. It's wonderful here. A lot of Americans, again, like I said. Getting annoying, but it's okay. I looked outside and thought I saw a dolphin. It wasn't. It was a diaper. Begins with D, so now happy days. It's going wonderfully, actually. There's so many activities on board. I woke up very early this morning and sat in a jacuzzi, which was great, like a marinating vegetable in soup. Yeah, there's so many things to do, and I'm spending my time ruminating, cogitating, thinking about our future on the radio waves, David, as I sail the sea waves. I feel I've become more philosophical on the sea. I might have a go and ask the captain if I can have a little bit of a go on the ship later. But yeah, apart from that, it's all going well. Hello to the listeners, no one, and you'll hear back from me tomorrow, hopefully having given the ship a little go. Au revoir, which is goodbye from the sea.
And finally, day three, Friday, April the 26th.
Ahoy there, David. I hope you're well. That's right, it's me, Tony Five, from the waves. Hope everybody is well and still slightly interested in my cruise. Just got to port again. That's where the ships park up. I'll fill you in with all the terminology as I go along. You know, I don't want to embarrass you. We're parked up at the port and we're in Dubrovnik, as I said. Beautiful city, a walled city in Croatia. But it's been good. I've been going out. I played bingo with some very old people. Pretty sure not all of them are going to make the cruise, but fuck it, why not? Met an American, amazing, Trump supporter, obsessed with walls and Mexicans. Couldn't work out why, but you know what? Everybody's got a hobby, right? And yeah, it's going well. I'm just about to get off board now and go for a wander about. But it's pretty fun. Again, loads of Canadians. You can't forgive them. Americans, very strange. A couple of Australians who are drunk pretty much 24/7. The cliches are pretty true. A lot of these guys can drink a hell of a lot and are very embarrassing. But apart from that, no, it's a great time. If you're being lazy, David, and not playing some sort of sea-based sound effect, can any of the listeners who respond, can you call in? He did promise me, because I can't hear this obviously, to play some sort of lovely sea-based soundtrack before he introduces me. Start boycotting. I mean, there's only about 7 or 8 of you listening anyway, so maybe drop it down to 3 or 4 until he obviously puts a soundtrack on. Make America great again. Take care, guys.
Our top story tonight takes us across the pond, all the way to Manchester, England, where in a pub, a businesswoman, having a few too many, along with an unfortunate guess about her age, resulted in a mishap. It's the classic, how old do you think I am question gone terribly wrong. So picture it, a 39-year-old entrepreneur, I repeat, 39-year-old woman, who apparently moonlights as a ninja at children's parties, did not take kindly to being aged 4 years more than she was, which to me sounds like a premature midlife crisis. Now, after a man told her she looked older than she was, instead of just sulking or posting on Facebook about it, the woman reacted rather dramatically. She glassed him, not once, but twice. She smashed a glass across his face, and now this poor guy has a 4-inch gash souvenir on his face just for playing The Price is Age Right. The price is the right age. The price is not guessing the right age. He even tried to escape to the bathroom, which gives a whole new meaning to the phrase, a crappy night out. In court, the woman tried to defend herself by saying she was under the weather with low self-esteem because, you know, nothing says I'm feeling insecure like rearranging someone's facial features. The judge, though, showing a sense of mercy, decided jail for her was not the answer. Instead, the judge gave her a year of what I'll call don't break any more faces probation and some community service. Maybe she'll host face painting sessions for underprivileged youth? Just make sure who's ever running that keeps those glasses away. Now, the woman says she's very deeply sorry, probably realizing that facial scars are not the kind of lasting impression you want to leave on someone after a night out. And here's the kicker. The judge added this was all totally out of character for her, and she's not a public threat. Unless, of course, you're bad at guessing ages at a bar. So next time you find yourself in Manchester, maybe just stick to commenting on the weather. Don't guess anyone's age. It's safer, unless you want to engage in the newest extreme sport out there. Proceed with caution. You know him. It's science expert Dan Riskin coming up to tell us why cat pee sprayed on walls smells so much worse than cat pee sprayed in boxes. The answer may surprise you. Felis catus. Meow meow. Foo foo. Whiskers. Cats. They have evolved in strange ways to make us love them, which I do want to talk about before we talk about cat pee, here with Dan Riskin, science expert. Daniel, welcome to the show.
I'm really happy to be here. I'm kind of obsessed with the cat pee. So if you dilly-dally talking about brain parasites and other ways in which cats make us love them, I will be upset. We have to talk about the pee because the new this new paper about cat pee and why it stinks so bad is, I think, one of the neatest things to come out this week. And nobody wants to talk about it in mainstream media because they don't want to tell the real story of cats and their urine.
That big media agenda, not wanting to talk about cat pee.
The media agenda, the cat, all of like Fox News is run by this cat on a keyboard just going meow and just hitting it with its paw.
And the cat's like, I will make sure they don't tell stories about my urine because if they find out about my urine, they'll know that we rigged the election.
Yeah, catch and kill, man. You could tell it's obviously by a cat if cats are doing it. It's the same old thing.
January 6th, cats sprayed their urine all over Congress. That's why they scaled the walls, and that's why they stormed
the House. It was cats.
Okay, fine. I'll talk about the way cats have weirdly evolved to get us to love them, including infecting our brain with a fungus that you claim is a virus or something else.
No, it's not a fungus or a virus. It's a protozoan. It's called toxoplasma, and it's not either of those things. It's a little thing.
I still refer to it as the cat brain fungus. But I will say this: before I got my cat, the idea and the smell of cat urine was so unpalatable to me. It's funny.
You didn't want to eat cat urine. Yeah.
I'm like, now I'm going to say the opposite's happened.
Yeah, keep going. I want to know where this is going. I've got a frozen puck of cat urine. Are you hungry?
It's not the urine.
Would you like to put that on your tongue?
It's just the litter is so tasty, but it's so dry.
It's a little sandy. Yeah. Once you get that urine on the top, on the roof of your mouth against your palate, because it's so palatable now, mm-hmm. is what you were going to say, right?
Yes. My cat's litter is actually made from corn, which I don't know if it's the corn lobby in the U.S. or what, but not important. I'm just saying, I used to be so grossed out by my cat's box. And now when I clean it, I'm like, oh, his adorable little poops and pees. And he sprays all over the box. He doesn't spray out of the box. He's neutered. But I'm always like, oh, you're a pee artiste. And so I run around my house chasing him after I clean his box saying, you're a pee artiste. You're a pee artiste. I don't know what it is, but I think my brain's infected with the fungus and I now love my cat.
Yeah, there's a good chance you have this parasite if you like your cat's pee that much. So when the parasite infects rats, it makes the rats sexually aroused by cat urine. So they're more likely to go hang out where there are cats, because it just, when you get sexually aroused by something, you will do it, whatever it is. That's just how the brain works. Whatever is arousing is what people do. And so it also works for rats. And so this is how this parasite, by infecting rats and making them get turned on by cat urine, they increase the odds that the rat is going to get picked off by a cat, and thus the parasite get into a cat and thus complete its reproductive cycle. So it's a brilliant move by this parasite, which has nothing to do with the smell of cat urine. Well, it does actually have to do with the smell of cat urine, but I guess I could have linked this more with that story, because this is a story about why cat urine smells so bad.
I'm not ready for the story yet. I got one more thing. One more thing.
I transitioned. I was getting us across the line.
I know you. I know at the very beginning, you're like, don't dilly-dally. I want to get the story out. But the other thing is, people say cat meows have evolved. Co-evolved with us or whatever to sound like babies. So we love them more. And I never thought that was true. But my cat caterwauls, as it's said. They wail.
Oh, whoa, whoa.
Wow, wow. And the other day, there was a baby outside. And I live in Manhattan. I don't have double pane windows. So I hear this baby wailing in the street. And I don't realize it's a baby at first. I'm like, kitty, shut up. What is your issue? I already fed you.
Interesting.
And then I realize it's not him. And a baby in the street sounded just like my cat. And that's when I realized they do sound the same. I always thought it was BS. Anyway, those are the ways in which cats have evolved to get us to love them.
What if babies are mimicking cats? Maybe babies have realized that people take care of their cats. And so the babies have evolved a coo that sounds very much like a meow.
I mean, humanity did evolve out of Africa. And cats... Yeah. Evolved from the African wildcat, so.
Yeah, so it could be they were around. I mean, I got to think about, like, what other cats sound like. Like, I guess nobody, they do meow sometimes, right? I haven't listened to a lot of cat noises.
They trill, they chirp. My cat's got a vocabulary of about 100. He says 100 different noises.
Really? He's a parrot.
Yeah, he purrs, he trills, he meows, he whines, he growls. Like, there's so many different noises they make. It's wild. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
That's cool. And you've got a good microphone.
I do.
I think what I would like you to do is have a soundboard of different noises that your cat makes so that you can play them as we go. Or you could have a game called, like, is this a baby in the street crying in Manhattan? Or is this my cat?
I don't know. I he's not going to perform at the mic, so I'd have to chase him with my phone on record, which admittedly I've done, which I'll play for you another time. All right. I dilly-dallied. We still have about 5 minutes. Cat pee. Smells.
Well, now I don't know if I want to tell you the story because you made me wait so long. But I'll tell you because I can't stop myself. So there's this question. Why, when a cat sprays the side of the litter box, does it stink so bad? Because cat in the litter box smells a little bit, but it doesn't smell as bad as cat that's sprayed a wall. Cat urine that's sprayed from, like, a male marking their territory smells terrible. And people have always assumed it's because they probably have some other gland that's near the exit for the urine that they add a little bit of spice to the mix so that the urine that gets sprayed is actually chemically different from the urine that's in the kitty litter that doesn't smell quite as bad.
They make it piquant. They add a little spice.
Yeah, a little piquant. Yeah, just adding a little habanero or a little something. But there's no evidence that they do have those glands. And so researchers were like, well, let's check. And they couldn't find them using the glands when they sprayed, and they did a chemistry. They looked at the chemistry of sprayed urine, or urine that was peed on the floor, or from the bottom of a kitty litter, so it had dripped down through. I guess they had to use a kitty litter that was non-absorbent in order to collect the samples. But nonetheless, they got those two urines, and then they even took two cats, anesthetized them, and took a syringe and withdrew urine from their bladders, so it was not even peed out at all and would have no opportunity to go past a gland. And all three of those urine samples were exactly the same. There's no difference among them. So there's something about being sprayed on a wall that makes it stinkier than when it's sprayed in the kitty litter. And what they've narrowed down on is a protein that's in cat urine called cauxin, C-A-U-X-I-N. If you're playing Scrabble, that could be a good word. I don't know if it'll be allowed. May not be in the Scrabble dictionary. It was only discovered, I think, in the early 2000s. It's known to be functional in handling other proteins, and especially proteins that have sulfur in them. So it's related to smell stuff. But what this study shows is that cauxin makes the surface tension of the urine go way down. And males that are intact that do a lot of spraying, they have a lot more of this cauxin in their urine. And so it is not, the surface tension is much lower. And the reason that matters is because when you have surface tension, you get beading. And so if you have a drop of liquid on a surface and there's good strong surface tension because there's no cauxin, then it's going to be a bead and none of the smells are going to be able to escape because they're all sort of in the liquid. But because cauxin makes the pee really, really runny, when they spray a wall, it just streaks right down the wall, exposing all of those flavorful chemicals that don't get out otherwise. And so it's because the surface tension of cat urine is so low that it's able to secrete all those smells. And so all this, it's like the bouquet just gets opened up because cauxin gets the other fluids out of the way.
That's amazing.
Was
aeration have anything to do with it? Or is it really just, okay, if it streaks down a wall, it's going to expose all the flavor, and if it puddles on the floor, not so much.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, aeration's got to be part of it. They, like, when you get a waft going through, it does something, and maybe the cat even does something that causes the aeration. Like, who knows? But nonetheless, they were able to show that, like, it's just basically the angle of the surface they spray on that makes the difference.
My kitty does two kinds of pees. He sprays on the wall of his litter box. He's got an enclosed litter box. He does not spray out of the box. He's a good kitty. And then he pees on the ground. And I've noticed it smells sometimes and not others. Now I know the answer why, but sometimes he kind of kicks up litter against the pee on the wall. So it's like sort of a crusted wall. And when it dries, it looks just like a Parmesan crisp. And so I always say to my girlfriend, oh, kitty's made Parmesan crisps. I have officially ruined Parmesan crisps for my girlfriend. She can no longer eat them because my cat creates them. Are they edible? That will leave as an exercise to the listener, whether I've tried them or not.
Very nice, very nice. I do think that's very funny. I imagine that you had this whole relationship based around like Parmesan crisp Thursdays that you guys always used to have together. Like it was the thing that kept you together, and you've had to rebuild the relationship from the ground up ever since the kitty litter came into the picture.
The fact that I'm doting over my cat and his toilet habits, I can't even recognize myself having previously never owned a pet. My question for you is, do you get this way over your kids and their diapers? Do you go from like, ugh, a diaper to be like, oh, it's adorable. Little Jimmy made a diarrhea.
Yeah. Yeah.
It happens to all parents, whether it's animals or children.
Parents really. Yeah. It's cute. It's, oh, isn't it cute the way they're blah, blah. And then you're like, that's not cute. That's just super annoying, but you're a parent, so you're dumb.
All right, Dan, let's take a quick break. Come back.
Yeah.
Closing out.
Yeah.
What? Okay. All right. All right. Let's, oh yeah, fine. The answer is yes. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks.
I have officially used an egg timer that you recommended to time the length of our talk right now. I'm angry about it because I have my own timer that works with my system. I got a system. You're forcing me to not use my system, but I'm doing it for you because I like you. Okay? You're welcome.
Well, we all grow, and I'm really excited about my timer. I have a specific URL that I use. Anybody who's listening, it's called scottseverance.us/timer. I just found it once, but it's really good because it's a big timer and it times down, but it so you can see how much time you have left to talk, but it doesn't make a noise. And then when you run out of time, it keeps counting up the other way in a different color. So you can very clearly see how much time you've gone over and how badly you need to be quiet, or how much time you wasted at the beginning of this segment talking about timers when you should have been talking about science. Hypothetically, that could happen.
Here's my issue with it, and this is going to bore pretty much everyone, including people who know what I'm about to talk about, which is likely no one, because no one's as big a nerd as me. The programming language that you build websites in, there's a few of them, but the one that really is kind of the underlying programming language where you want to have an interactive website, like a timer, for example, it's called JavaScript, okay?
Yes.
And JavaScripts, or JavaScript, as I used to say in Canada when I lived there, until I moved to the U.S. and was an engineer, and everyone made fun of me for saying JavaScript, so I switched to JavaScript.
That's so funny, yeah. I still say pasta sometimes just to get my American wife upset.
There you go. Okay, so, I didn't know your wife was American. You get a green card, no problem.
Yeah, I think I could get one. My kids are all, they have dual citizenship. My wife has dual citizenship. She's from Minnesota.
I'm eligible to apply for American citizenship in 1 year, pretty much to the date. Hmm.
That's exciting.
I don't know if I will. There's tax things. There's things, but we'll see. Not important.
There are tax things, but you live there.
I do live there. I have been here 12 years. God, where does the time go? The underlying programming language actually has really lousy, like, utilities to keep time accurately.
Oh, interesting.
You can, but the kind of the default tools that this programming language provides you doesn't account for clock drift. So you could like start a timer and then an hour later be off by a second, and the language really sets you up for that kind of failure. Of course, there are ways to mitigate it. Of course.
That's a lot. An hour later be off by a second?
There you go. So having said that, I don't really trust timers written in websites. Now, have we bored everyone to the point where they've tuned out? Yes. Definitely. Is our topic that we're about to get to about AI going to continue to do so? Maybe. But it does involve humor. It involves jokes. It involves comedy writing. Is AI good at comedy writing?
Is AI good at comedy? No. I mean, it's not bad, but AI can do a good job of helping people do comedy. So the picture that's emerging from people, like, there have been a lot of studies now about, like, what happens if we give somebody AI and they use it in the workplace? How do they improve, right? So, like, computer programmers. Let's give a bunch of computer programmers an AI GitHub sort of plugin, and let's give a bunch of other computer programmers no plugin and see the difference. And programmers that can use AI can program way faster.
Copilot, it's called. I've used it. It's okay. It's all right.
Yeah, but it might not come up with the higher level creative ideas, but like when you just have to implement, like, okay, can you put this in here, or can you fix the code, or where's my problem here? Like just finding where you forgot to close a parenthesis or a bracket or whatever, it can be very helpful. So it does improve software engineers' time doing a standardized task by like 56% faster. If you take people that are working at a call center and you give them an AI assistant that gives them suggestions of what to say next when they're talking to, when they're fixing problems for people, it improves, I forget what the number is, but like they get significantly 18% better at solving problems. So it helps there too. And so now the question is, what about being funny? Like, could I be funnier if I had AI assistance? And so this is a study where they basically, you know, the New Yorker has those comics?
Yeah, I love them.
Yeah, and they have like a picture, and then you have to come up with a funny caption that goes with it.
Yeah, my favorite one, it's actually my Twitter picture. It's two people at a bar, a man and a woman, and the man turns to the woman and he says, "I'm thinking of stopping a podcast," which to me is the funniest, because you know everyone's always like, "I'm thinking of starting a podcast," yeah. You know?
Anyway, that's funny.
Go on. And then there's that's the one. One. And there's
was
the
that
one.
Was that a suggested line that somebody made for that New Yorker?
No,
was
this, it one is, of those, this is an old one. And then my favorite one is from like the 90s, where there's a couple of dogs on a computer, and one dog says, "On the internet, no one knows you're a dog," which is profound, right? Like you could pretend to have a huge business. You could be anyone. Anyway, okay. Yes, I know the comics. I love the comics.
Yeah. Well, they have this thing where they put up a comic and you have to like submit ideas for the... So one that I just... I won't say... One that I saw recently, I always worry that your listeners are like looking at which issue of New Yorker they have, and they're like, wait a second, he said today, but we got this one last week. So anyway, never mind. I just
singular, went off, my listener. We refer
yeah,
to them
your listener.
Singular.
So it's a woman, I think, sitting at a table in a restaurant across from a spiral galaxy, and they're like, and he's saying something to the spiral galaxy, and people had to come up with a funny punchline for it. And the one that people sent in, the one that won, was one that said, you could have told me the picture was 13.8 billion years old.
I love those comics.
That's so funny. Oh, gosh. Oh, that is funny. Because pictures of galaxies, they're really billions of years.
You're losing it. You finally lost it.
Just I haven't had a good laugh about that one out loud yet. And saying it out loud really was cathartic for me. So they did an experiment. This is Australian researchers, and I love this. I love this. What they did is they took New Yorker, where they have the picture, and then they gave it to people. They gave each person 20 of them. And for half, for 10, they just had to come up with a punchline on their own. And for the other half, they got AI assistance. And AI didn't write a punchline for them, but what AI did is kind of profound. What the way the AI worked is they took the picture, they described the picture to the AI, and then the AI used this crazy analysis that's based on contrasts that comes up with things from the picture or suggestions related to the picture that might work as a punchline. So it's pretty crazy. It's like so you give it, I've got a guy in a business suit, or sorry, a guy in a bunny suit in an office holding a briefcase and a piece of paper, and somebody saying something behind their back. And then you describe that to the AI, and the AI says, okay, all right, so you got business, you got a suit, you got bunny, and so all these different pieces. And then it looks for things that are disjuncted that might make for a funny punchline. And so suit rhymes with the word soup, and soup is related to rabbits. And so maybe soup is in there somewhere. And so it comes up with these ideas of words that might be useful. And then the idea is that the people using AI assistance don't get a punchline from it, but it helps their brainstorm. They just have some other words to throw around and play with. And then they look at and then they had independent people judge all the punchlines and see whether the AI-assisted ones were funnier. And there are two main findings. One, overall, it does actually improve the humor that people use by about 5%. Like there's about a 5% higher score on average for how funny it was. But the thing that really was interesting is that the effect was almost completely isolated to people who spoke English as their second language. So people that speak English natively might have a much easier time coming up with a funny joke and understanding how to use language in a way to be funny. Whereas people that live in a country where they don't speak English and they speak it outside their first language, like if they live in Sri Lanka, but they're fluent in English, humor just might be a little bit harder for them. And those are the people that saw the biggest jump in how funny they were if they used AI. Across the board, everybody using AI took longer to come up with a punchline, but overall the quality was improved for people that needed the help. And for people who didn't need the help, they stayed about as funny as they were anyway.
What's amazing to me is these demonstrate that it's possible. And what's scary to me is we know in the future it'll get better and better and better. And so anywhere where AI is shown to do like even a 0.5% improvement, the worry is, okay, in the future, it'll take that person's job or it will.
Right.
I don't know. I think we've had this conversation before, but I, up until recently, was completely convinced that AI could not be creative. It's crazy for me to even say that now, but I thought AI will never write a good song. AI will never write a good joke. AI will never be a great artist, as it were. Now I'm not convinced of that at all. I think that in the future, not only will it be great, you won't be able to tell the difference between the great human-created stuff and the great AI. You'll just have to trust who's ever putting it out. Or maybe it won't matter. Maybe we can consume.
I think it does matter. I really do think that there's something. If I knew AI had come up with that, I'd be like, oh, that's interesting. But
yes,
if I knew a person came up with it, you're like, oh, that's clever.
But
I
if
like
you
that
could be easily fooled and you think you're not being fooled, doesn't matter. It's like this ignorance is bliss kind of thing.
Yeah, but I do think, so that's going to put a premium on things that are real, right? And it's going to make it, you know, it's like, I want a handcrafted, look, this was built by hand. Like you can have a factory built piece of art, or you can have a piece of art that somebody built, and one of them is going to be way more expensive to make, and it's going to take a lot longer, it's going to have imperfections, but that's the one you want, right? If you're buying art, you want something that was made by somebody's hands.
Yeah, but you could counterfeit art with imperfections. Like AI will get that good, maybe not in our lifetime.
Yeah, there have always been swindlers doing stuff like that. I guess, for me, the take home from this is that I'm not the funniest person in the world. I'm a little funny, but I'm not the funniest in the world. Maybe AI could help with that. But also, it's not about the funniness. It's about the ability of AI to help those people for whom it was not easy, right? And so it took whatever their weakness was and improved it. So like for me, AI is about writing a convincing argument or PR or a press release or whatever. Like wherever my weak spots are, that's where maybe AI can help me. And then I can continue to be good at the things I'm good at.
Yeah, I use it to help me with things like that too. And sometimes I'll just use it as a suggestion to kind of get my brain going. Yeah. And then I'll write it myself. I do it for emails. I do it for letters, you know.
Yep.
Yeah. So Dan, your timer that you suggested to me that we talked about earlier is flashing in my face. I hate it. And you can see it flashing in the background, probably.
I can see it. If it's really nice, you know what? It makes me feel like you're a friend, that you took my suggestion and you acted on it. That's one way. Studies have shown that's a really great way to endear yourself to people, is to ask their advice and then take their advice. And you've done that with me. You didn't ask for my advice, but I gave you my advice, so that was part of it. And then you took my advice, even because I had to ask you three times to do it. And then you did it, and now I feel really endeared to you.
And I hate like it. More. But at least now I know that I hate it.
Yeah, we tried it. All I wanted you to do was try it.
I tried. Daniel Kenneth Riskin, PhD, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I am David Cooper, and you are listening to This Is Going Well. I think, in the sense that I think you are listening to this show because you can hear me, and I think if you were not listening, it would not be going well, and you would not be listening to This Is Going Well, I think, with David Cooper. Carmi Levy, tech expert, is coming up next to talk about some tech stories, including TikTok. Carmi, hello to you.
David.
Oh, it's a song day. How are you? Happy whatever. Who cares? It's another day. Well,
every day is special. It doesn't have to be a holiday to be a holiday. And I think today should be that day for everybody.
Happy holiday, whatever you're
celebrating.
I agree with you, except every day should be horrible. There shouldn't be misery in your life or in the news or in the world for you to be miserable. You can be miserable every day.
That's true. Or you can just choose to be like my dog, who doesn't know of any of these things and is just happy to be alive.
Yes. Or like my cat, who has complicated feelings about being alive.
Oh, she'll be happy if you give her a treat and a pet.
It's a he. How dare you?
Oh, I'm sorry.
How dare you misgender my cat?
I misgendered your cat. Oh, I'm sorry.
My trans friend always calls my cat a she. And then he's like, oh my God, what have I done? I'm like, who cares, dude? It's a cat. You know?
The cat isn't offended. We're okay.
It's like liberalism gone mad. Okay, never mind. Okay, let's talk game emulators. Before we talk TikTok, to be honest, I'm a little sick of TikTok. Game emulators. I guess I'll say what they are. That's when you're just running your regular old computer, minding your own business, but then you can play Nintendo 64 games on it or something like that.
Yeah. Who doesn't want to go back in time? I mean, and emulators have been sort of the hacker's best friend since the beginning of time. You know, we all grew up playing games. I played Atari, Nintendo, Sega, you name it there. I've just dated myself. And wouldn't we love to go back in time with a technology that doesn't require us to buy the hardware, but allows us to play those games on existing new modern hardware? And that's where emulators come in. There's one called Delta that lets you play a whole bunch of Nintendo games on a modern device, on an iOS device. And Apple, of course, has fought these tooth and nail. If you went into the Apple App Store for years, you couldn't find one because Apple was terrified of these things. You're going to install an emulator and now there's going to be all these games that you play that Apple can't control. Oh my God.
And there's strange copyright rules, right? The companies that made, they gave you a cartridge. They didn't give you a copy of the source code. And so when people rip the code off these cartridges, it's unclear who the licenses go to. It's unclear whether they're now in the public domain because the manufacturers are no longer around and they're no longer being for sale. Like, for example, some of those arcade games from the 70s and 80s, the code for them is now in the public domain and they sit with the Library of Congress in the US. So there's also copyright issues, but also there's controlling the quality of what people are playing. So there's a lot of interesting threads to why companies allow or don't allow or are scared of retro emulators, Carmi.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we certainly are in some cases, very sketchy copyright legal territory without really clear or pat answers. And then there's also just the very nature of Apple's business. If you look at an iPhone next to an Android device, Apple is all about controlling the experience. You can only get apps onto an iPhone one way through the App Store. Whereas if you know what you're doing with an Android device, you can either use the App Store or you can sideload. You know, you can play the hacker, you can download stuff from the web. Of course, it means that the Android experience is a little more roll up your sleeve, kind of. And Apple has always been about that control, and they've exerted that. They're afraid of losing that control over their ecosystem. And an emulator is the easiest way to do that, because once someone installs that, then within the emulator, they can kind of do whatever they want. It's another reason why those apps like WeChat, they call them super apps, because they do a bunch of different things. You can play mini games within them. You can run mini apps. It's an app within an app. And Apple doesn't necessarily like that, because if everything is an emulator, then Apple can't tell us what to use and how to use it.
That's interesting how you put it, an app within an app. Like, you ship the framework on the App Store, Apple approves the framework, and then within your app, you can just load and do whatever you want. The lines, code-wise, are actually kind of blurry. What's an app within an app and what's an app? But I see why Apple is being so controlling here. However, I do not agree with it. This is one of the things that I hate about Apple. They're protectionist business practices, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah, that's a very polite way of saying it. But you know, the good news here is that Apple is being forced to change. There are winds blowing on the horizon in Europe. There's the Digital Markets Act that has just become law that kind of reins in that kind of behavior, doesn't allow companies like Apple to exert that tight a level of control over their ecosystems. In the U.S., the Department of Justice just launched that huge antitrust lawsuit against Apple, saying that it behaves like a monopoly, partly because of these kinds of rules within its app store. So Apple is doing it, but it's not because it wants to. It's doing it because it's kind of being forced to, very grudgingly. It realizes that the regulatory landscape around the company is changing, and that if they don't start playing ball and start loosening those reins a little bit and allowing us to do a little bit more within their ecosystem than we have in the past, that they're going to be subject to some very significant fines, very significant prosecutions. So they're just really sending a message to the governments, look, we can be nice too. We'll allow emulators and super apps on our app store. Please don't sue us. Please don't fine us, because we really don't want to deal with that. That's really what this is all about. It's not like Tim Cook woke up one day and suddenly felt altruistic and said, I think I really want to play some Nintendo games on my iPhone. Let's get this on the app store. No, he was forced into it.
Interesting. I feel like Apple, either when they're forced to do things like this by either the Justice Department or the EU, they either release it quietly, maybe with a degraded interface. They don't really tell customers. They just say, fine, we'll do it. Not going to tell anyone about it. Or they do the opposite. They make this big announcement. Hey, this thing, like this universal charger, is a great new feature, and it was our idea to begin with. I feel like it's either one or the other with Apple all the time.
Yeah. Please pat us on the back because we're being good corporate citizens. No, this is definitely the former in this case. It's a quiet one. I looked for the press release on emulators in the App Store. Couldn't find it. I know a lot of the folks who do PR for Apple, they certainly weren't announcing it. Folks just sort of found it in the App Store, and that sort of drove the news cycle. So no, this is going to be one of those quiet changes, and it'll be interesting to see, because of course we know that the European Union is also looking at Apple for possible antitrust violations. The Digital Markets Act gives them a lot more kind of latitude to start holding companies like Apple and others, Google, Amazon, to account. So they're already sniffing around the perimeter, and we're going to see more action like this in the months to come. And I think a lot of things that might have frustrated us about using our devices, the limits that were put on them, might start to disappear in the months to come as things start to change. It's going to become a little friendlier for consumers, whether these companies like it or not.
Good. Now, speaking of friendliness to consumers from large tech companies, one thing I found not so friendly, Carmi, is when Netflix stopped letting me use my girlfriend's parents' account. And it's not that I can't afford the, what, 12, 16 bucks a month for an account. It's that I simply will not, because I'm mad at Netflix for doing this. It just felt like one of those things where a big, huge company does one extra inch of squeezing out of consumers to get the money, but then eventually what they'll turn into is the very thing they sought to fix. Like, eventually, yeah. I think Netflix is going to have commercials and feel like big box cable. Amazon Prime's already doing it at the lowest tier pricing. For a paid account, Amazon is charging you, sorry, is forcing you to watch ads or you pay more money. So I feel like these big streaming companies, they tried to fix a problem and now they're turning more and more like the jerks that they stole market share from. And this to me was another example of Netflix doing it, but it may not have been a terrible business decision, Carmen.
No, it was terrible for consumers, and I'm on your side. We were a family where our kids, they're off to school, living on their own, and we were sharing passwords with them as well, and we were caught in that, and now, of course, the kids have to have their own accounts. And so they looked the other way for the longest time, Netflix, and kind of ignored it, nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
They looked the other way. I think they liked it. I thought
they did, because it drove engagement. Exactly. To give people another thing to talk about, and it resulted in bigger numbers, bigger subscriber numbers. It made everybody happy.
And their biggest competition for a while was customers who were stealing the service. So the number one was Netflix consumers, and then number two were people who shouldn't be using Netflix. So they were competing against themselves, stealing a bigger market share. It made sense. I think they wanted it until they saw the moment where they could go back on it.
Well, right, because I think what changed was, for the longest time, Netflix was the only player in town. And then along came Apple, and along came Disney, and along came a bunch of other competitors, Amazon. And now suddenly they're competing for that sort of subscriber pie. So you only have a certain budget for streaming subscriptions every month. And Netflix used to be the only company that was asking for that subscription. Now there are multiples. And because the economy is maybe not doing so well and people are worried about revenue, they're looking at their monthly budget and going, which one can I cut? I've got an average of 2.5 of these subscriptions in my pocket. I don't really watch all of them. I'm going to cut one. So Netflix, the things that we got away with before, where it could avoid sort of trying to scrape for additional revenue because subscribers were growing double digits every year, well, now they can't afford that anymore. And they've got to start sort of making their landscape a little bit more efficient. So the bad news for consumers, though, is really good news if you are a shareholder in Netflix, because their income has gone up by over 54% in the last quarter alone, and then they added over 9 million subscribers. And so the numbers are basically proving they were right, that folks who were stealing the password are now paying for the privilege. They
got their own subscriptions. Not me! I'm not going to admit that I pirate Netflix shows, because I would never do that, but I don't use Netflix.
I will not bear your secret, I promise.
No, of course I would never do that. I'm just saying it's an option. It's an illegal option. I would never recommend it, but I don't pay for Netflix. Carmi, when we come back, we're going to take apart the TikTok ban that was just passed as law in the U.S. and what that looks like. How bad is it really going to be for people using the platform and the company, and what happens next? We're here with Carmi Levy. Stick around. TikTok, or as the Germans say, tic-tac. Did you know that, Carmi Levy, tech expert in Germany? Clocks don't say TikTok, TikTok. They say tic-tac, tic-tac.
That makes me hungry. I mean, that sounds, feels like a breath mint.
But, it does. It does. And I feel like, I think it's like in Japanese, cats don't say meow. They say like row. And
how do they know? How do they know it's a different language? And I know, they're smart cats.
And I think like in Arabic languages, dogs don't say woof, they say ark ark or something. It's crazy when you think about it, like people who come from different linguistic backgrounds think that animals make different sounds, which I guess just goes to show they don't just make one stereotypical sound. But
exactly.
This had absolutely nothing to do with a law that I think, I don't know how effective it's going to be, honestly. A TikTok ban passed by and signed by the U.S. government, forcing the company to divest from Chinese ownership and be passed on to U.S. ownership. Now, what are the laws around what percentage of a public company can be owned by a foreign entity? So I just think they're going to create a shell company. I mean, I'm probably wrong. I'm not a market and finance expert, but the U.S. is forcing TikTok to be sold because of Chinese control of the company. And yeah. I think it's a good thing. I just don't think it's enough. I don't think it's going to really solve any problems. What's your take on this?
Well, yeah, they call it the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, or I guess it's PAFACA, which rhymes with alpaca. But it's one of those sort of cases where, yeah, you're telling Americans that it's not about a ban, that it's about safety for Americans. We know that, we know that the app is an aggressive digital harvester. TikTok collects more information from our phones than the average app that's already on our phones. They all do it, of course. That's the way the digital economy works. It sucks data off your phone, and then it uses that information to send controlled, customized ads back to you. That's the way it works. But of course, in TikTok's case, because it's owned by ByteDance, a Chinese company, there's concern that that data then goes to China, that the company, if the Chinese government asks us to see that data, that they must give it to them. They say they haven't, but again, we don't really know. A lot of smoke and mirrors there. There's no smoking gun, but there's a lot of sort of questions about where that data ends up. So, you know, the U.S. government has essentially said, we want to clamp down on that. And we feel that a ban, if the company does not sell itself to an American entity by the end of that 9 months, which will be into January of next year, that they will be subject to a ban, which, you know, where I sit is this is more political than anything else. If you really were interested in protecting your citizens from nefarious beings or entities soaking up data from our smartphones through the apps that we download, you wouldn't just be singling out TikTok and going after one app. You'd be looking through the millions of apps in both app stores, both Google and Apple and other sources, and identifying what all of their connections are to Chinese interests, and coming up with a blanket solution that doesn't just remove one app from the equation. Because even if TikTok does go dark, there are lots of other ways for the Chinese government to surveil us through our devices. So more political than anything else. And I think it makes for great theater. But at the end of the day, if they really wanted to protect Americans, this wouldn't be the way to do it.
Yeah. A lot of people are happy about this. I myself am conflicted. I'm thinking, is this really about protecting the U.S. from foreign propaganda, data thievery, or is this just everyone taking it out on the Gen Zs? Because 10 years ago, they were children, they were in diapers, then the pandemic happens, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they're around, and they're way cooler than all of us. Thank you, Zendaya. Thank you, Zendaya. I don't know. I feel like it's an app associated with a generation that, you know, the elders feel is could be subversive, and they're taking it out on them. And I actually feel good about that because I hate that they're cooler than me. But in reality, I shouldn't feel that way. That's not a good way to feel.
I think you make a really interesting point, because I don't think people take
TikTok seriously.
Wait,
to be clear,
seriously.
I made that point idiotically, but there was an underlying point there.
But I think there's a general thread of belief throughout society, particularly the older the demographic, is in that TikTok is not an app to be taken seriously. It's an app where you dance in front of your friends and you come up with silly videos that hopefully go viral and get you a following. It's where influencers go. Nothing of substance is said or shared or accomplished on TikTok. It's a place where we go to waste time, and we watch one video, and 3 hours later, because the algorithm served up Lord knows how many others, we wonder what the heck hit us. So I don't think it's an app that people take seriously. They don't realize that it's the core, the pillar of a multi-billion-dollar sub-economy. And so I think if you're going to identify a target to make a political statement, you pick the one that isn't serious. And I think TikTok, unfortunately, is a victim of its own popularity, and perhaps unfairly so, is seen in that regard. No one really takes it as, with that, let's call it gravity, that it probably deserves.
They think that TikTok is making them hate the U.S. government. But in reality, taking it away from the kids, it's going to make them hate you more, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And ask the average kid who's using TikTok, do they really know or even care what's happening under the surface? Do they care where the data is going? Do they care who may or may not have access to it? No, they just want to do their thing. They're suffering from fear of missing out, FOMO, just like everyone else. And because all their buddies are now in the digital town square known as TikTok, they want to be there too. And they have no care in the world about the political overtones of this app. And it shows that we care more about convenience, we care more about social standing than we do about personal or even national security.
Here's my half-baked idea how to address this problem, because it not only addresses it for TikTok, but it addresses it for Twitter, for Facebook, for any social media platform where mm-hmm. propaganda or false information, misinformation, disinformation can exist. Mm-hmm. I think rather than try to regulate the company's ownership, if you have, say, more than a million users and some algorithm that surfaces stories, data, posts to people, that mm-hmm. algorithm should be open, forced to be open sourced. And yep. that the way that data gets surfaced should be disclosed as part of a company's disclosures. If they're public, I think it should also affect private companies. Basically, if you have more than N number of users and you serve them up some data that's post-like, mm-hmm. I don't know how you'd make this rigorous using a law, but there would be a way to do it, I assume. If you serve up that data in a feed, in a timeline, the way that you collect that data and the way that you surface that data should be publicly disclosed. There's another yeah. whole issue of, are these algorithms AI? Are they too complicated to publicly disclose? But that's besides the point. Mm-hmm. That way you find out, hey, is the Chinese government just surfacing propaganda to young people, making them believe falsehoods about the U.S. government, or are they not? And that way, and then it has nothing to do with ownership. It has to do with what's really going on. Now, is what I'm describing possible? I don't know. And I'm a computer scientist by education, so I don't even know if it's possible to do something like that. But that's my half-baked idea. Don't attack who's owning it. Attack how the information is being surfaced.
In the ideal world, I'd love to see that, because opaqueness of the algorithms really has been at the core of the problem. We don't know how these things are being fed up to us, and quite frankly, that's the secret sauce. But, you know, I think we would have better luck, going up to Coca-Cola or KFC and asking them for their original recipe or the 13
spices.
Yeah, but
their original recipe is potentially indoctrinating children to believe falsehoods about the government. Although Coca-Cola is delicious.
These companies will fight it tooth and nail, because they'll say that that is intellectual property that forms the core of the very value of their business. And so they won't take it sitting down. Already the Chinese government has said that if a sale is in the offing, they will never allow their core technology, specifically the algorithm, to be transferred to a foreign entity. So we know that they're sensitive, even if it's a domestically owned company. Now that it's kind of a transnational potential transaction, it's even more sensitive. And as much as I'd like to see algorithms opened up, because I think that would kind of address a lot of the abuses that we've been seeing in the space over the past number of years, the industry is going to fight that tooth and nail. They'll throw every legal resource they can at it to prevent the governments from getting their way.
And maybe I'm an idiot here, but what's preventing China from, like, you know, hiring a puppet CEO, incorporating in Delaware, because that's where Nothing. All major U.S. corporations yeah. incorporate, and then having a board of directors be Chinese nationals and having basically Chinese oversight of a shell American corporation. Like,
oh, nothing. They've already tried doing it within their existing corporate structure. Three of their five board members are American, and they claim that. They say, you know, this is not a Chinese company. We are, our leadership is majority American, so how can you call us not American? So they're already playing that game. Mm. Wouldn't surprise me if they took it to another level as we get closer to that January deadline.
And, like, how do we know that these people on the board aren't just, you know, like, are either there, yeah. proxies for the Chinese government? Who knows? I just mean,
we'll never know, which is why trying to carve off the TikTok entity in the U.S. and make it quote unquote American, I think it appeals really nicely to voters. But from a practical perspective, it's a ridiculous way of going about it. And if you really wanted to protect the interests of Americans, you would find other ways to do so.
Okay. I think we're in agreement here. We both hate TikTok, but I think the ban is not exactly... yeah. Not exactly the right idea.
Yeah, and it's not going to happen. We're going to get to next January, and there are so many obstacles and speed bumps that have to be sort of hit or bumped into between now and then that this isn't going to happen. And quite frankly, I don't think the American government has the stomach to actually follow through on it.
And the Chinese say they're going to fight it in the U.S. courts, which mm-hmm. will be very interesting to me, because the Supreme Court is incredibly pro-corporation, incredibly laissez-faire, incredibly conservative, but at the same time, they're very protectionist, because that's another feature of the American right. With those mm-hmm. majority justices being conservatives in the U.S. or Republicans or Republican nominees, I guess judges
yeah.
don't have an
accurate. It's going to be fun to see how that plays out, because, yeah, we know that TikTok has already announced that they will be suing the government, and they are going to be filing for an injunction. So make some popcorn, pull up a chair. It's going to be a fun show.
And I'm interested to see how the Supreme Court takes this one, because on the one hand, they're pro-corporation. On the other hand, they're very pro-America.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll see. Carmi, always a pleasure having you here. Thanks for discussing this with me.
So great being here with you, David. Thanks so much.
Mwah! Now, in a matter of moments, Ghost Guy Daniel, a ghost expert extraordinaire, will answer the question we've all been wondering. You've definitely been wondering this sometimes 45 times a day. The question, can ghosts make us sick? And also, will I confront this ghost expert as to whether ghosts are real? Yes, I will. Ghost Guy Daniel in a moment. I'm David Cooper. I'm here with ghost tour guide, podcast host in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, Ghost Guide Daniel. Ghost Guide Daniel, your first name is Ghost Guide, your last name is Daniel. Is that, did I get that right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. You can just call me Daniel.
Very good. Okay, first of all, how does one get interested in being a ghost tour guide? How do you go from, I don't know, growing up, going to high school? Were you always going to be this, or did it just something? Was it something in later in life you said, "Yes, this is me"?
Well, you know, I've always been a huge fan of history, and I find history is a gateway drug to loving ghosts because they're so interconnected. So I was a big history buff over the years. Hamilton, a very historic place, and then I got involved with a very haunted house in the city. And that kind of brought me over because I would hear all the legends and ghost stories. And one of the first articles I ever wrote was, the first one was a history one on the house. And then the second one was all about the ghosts. And then I found out that, you know, people love ghost stories. So it just kind of like pushed me into the business from there.
Do sales and tour attendances, do they skyrocket around the end of October, somehow correlating with pumpkins here?
Oh my goodness, you don't even realize. So yeah, when Halloween comes around, everybody is thinking about this stuff. It's just everything that can be offered gets sold out, especially if you've been doing it for a long time and people know about you. But that's the time. I mean, even regular folks who don't believe in ghosts will come forward to hear the ghost stories because everybody loves a good ghost story. So yeah, extremely busy during that time.
So let's talk about belief in ghosts. Was it something that you always had belief in, or was there a particular experience that you had or a particular piece of evidence that someone gave you that made you cross that threshold and say, ghosts are real, this stuff exists?
Well, I've always had an interest in it. I know for me personally, when I was growing up, I grew up in a historic house. It was over 100 years old, and there was experiences. I never had any, but my parents mentioned, my brother mentioned, supposedly a little boy was haunting the house. I sometimes heard footsteps at night, but you never know if it's just like a child's imagination or if it's really going on. So it was always set in my mind. And then later on, I just had a natural interest from the history aspect to get into investigations. So I started out as a paranormal investigator about 22 years ago, and then just kind of built from there. But going into haunted places and being constantly at these locations, I've had many experiences since that have pushed me over onto the believer side.
What would be the most standout experience?
Oh, there's been a few, but for me, I guess the most is in relation to the idea on how ghosts can make us sick. I did an investigation at a place in St. Catharines known as the Merritt House. For those who don't know, if you know the radio station 97.7 Hits FM, that's where they broadcast from. And it had something in there. Like, I don't know if I would call this, if it was ever actually alive at one point, but it was such a palpable energy. Like even a non-psychic like me could feel it. So after the tour, this thing tried to possess one of our psychics. So we witnessed that going on. And it was this strange coincidence of the minute one of the psychics cleared the other one and said that the spirit was gone, a light above her head actually turned off for a few seconds and turn back on again. So that was interesting. But then after this, whatever that thing was, it followed me home. So now I had this thing in my home. It was a condo apartment, and there was a certain part, like the living room.
They're haunting condos now. They're going from old houses to condos. This is frustrating.
It's nothing to do with the place, right? The old houses have the energy, but for me, it was like it followed me from another location. So not related to the condo. It's not technically home. There's no connection, right?
Benevolent or sort of evil or sort of neutral energy, the entity following you?
I wouldn't call it evil, definitely angry, and definitely restless.
Restless.
But as a good example is I'm not scared of the dark. And if you go into that area where it's haunting and you turn off all the lights, you immediately get anxiety. You immediately get dread, a feeling that you didn't normally have before all of that stuff started.
Okay. So I did want to talk to you about something specific. The question, can ghosts make us sick? I think the angle here is if you're living in a place that's haunted, or perhaps, as you say, ghosts can follow you somewhere, and it's sort of inhabiting, that's the word I'm looking for. It's inhabiting where you are along with you. Can it make you ill? Can it mess with your chi? Can it mess you up?
I like the term chi. That's great. Yes. Well, in the sense of making you sick, so it can get you started down a certain road. So I always warn people. They say, oh, can a haunting in my house be dangerous? And I say, no. I mean, there's nothing extreme like what you see in the horror movies. No knives are coming off the wall and flying towards your head. This stuff doesn't really happen. What will happen is if you're not prepared, if you're not against it, and if you're also an anxious person to have other problems in your life, a restless energy can make it worse. So then you start, you know, going down that mind chatter road of, you know, everything's horrible and I feel terrible. And then those feelings can also, you know, put you into actual physical sicknesses. I mean, this is something proven in psychology that if you're constantly negative thinking, that you will be sick more because you feel that way all the time. And
why are you attacking me right now? No, I'm kidding. I'm just guilty as charged with the anxiety. And then, you know, I know that cycle well.
I wouldn't have been able to tell by talking to you.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so, okay, but please keep going. So if something's inhibiting where you are, it can be a constant stressor, which can then make you ill or make you more prone to sickness.
Especially if you don't know about it. So if there's something in there that you're not aware of, or that was connected to antique in the house, or one of your family members, and they brought it in for whatever reason, and you're not aware of it, you could be having these extra feelings, and it could end up becoming a dangerous thing.
Dangerous thing to your health.
Well, yeah, it really does depend on the person's mindset, right? I'm not saying the ghost is going to be the one that can drive you down that path, but it can get you started and then spiral out of control from there.
Okay. So what is a ghost? I guess I'm, as a skeptic, I'm kind of like, I'm hearing it. I'm hearing what you're saying. I know it's true for you, but for me, I'm not saying it's false. I'm just saying I don't see enough evidence for this kind of stuff to believe it. That's kind of where I'm at. It's sort of like my relationship with God. I don't see enough evidence for the existence of God, so I don't believe it. But if I died and there was St. Peter at the pearly gates with the rolls or whatever, I'm a Jew, not a Christian, but I would believe at that point. Actually, I'd probably think I was hallucinating at first. I'd give it a few hours. But I would believe it given enough evidence. I guess for me to really understand this stuff, how would we sort of rigorously define what a ghost is?
Well, I mean, the paranormal is called the unknown for a reason. I mean, there's never going to be a certain amount. If I was a psychic, if that was my whole life, then obviously I'd be more of a believer, but that's not me. So for me, the idea is, I mean, has science not proven that everything in existence and reality is made up of energy? Like we're all basically vibrating atoms at different frequencies. So, I mean, if you just go down that road for a second, and realize how insane reality actually is, and it's all connected to energy, then I say if there's an emotional burst from a tragedy that occurs, and there's always more energy to emotion, that isn't it possible that a piece of that energy can get left behind? So there's residual in the sense that things happen over and over, but then there's tragic where it's just like a huge burst.
Okay, here's where I see that. I see that chemical reaction in people's brains, which would be, you know, the negative emotion, and the kind of isn't it possible leap. Yes, of course it's possible. But that same kind of leap can justify any belief, right? I could say, okay, Bigfoot exists. He's been hiding every time someone gets out a camera, but he's out there. Isn't it there? We see apes of a certain size. We see bones of dinosaurs that were huge. Isn't it possible? You know, like it, this kind of thinking could be used to justify any belief. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. But But I'm also like, okay, yes, the answer to the question is yes, it is possible. But it's it, for me, it's like not enough. Am I making sense? It's very, my brain is scrambled this morning.
Well, I mean, in one point of view, you could say anything in our reality cannot be proven. I mean, it's the same thing. If somebody tells you something and you just keep asking why over and over again, like what little kids do, right? Eventually, you're going to reach a point where you can't answer the question.
Yes.
And the reason is because no underlying proof of anything.
Fine. I mean, there are some presuppositions and we do have good evidence for a lot of things, which is how we're talking over the internet into our microphones. But ignoring all that, it's for me, when the little kid asks why and why and why, and you hit that barrier of the unknown, or perhaps even hit the barrier of what we can't know. You know, there are some untestable hypotheses, right? Like if the premise is, okay, ghosts can't be detected with certain kinds of equipment, we can't design an experiment to detect them. So I can't give you like a testable hypothesis here. For me, that's where I kind of just stop and I'm saying, well, it's okay not knowing, you know?
But it depends what you're using to test, right? There's a lot of investigators out there that do have a more scientific mind to this. So when they come in with their infrared cameras, for example, and there's proof of these wisps of heat that will come through a room or cold, and that's not supposed to be there. There's no windows or vents or anything like that. So there is some quote unquote scientific proof. Just the same thing, the idea that, you know, we have the internet today and we're chatting over it because of science. Well, these things that are starting to come out, and I'm not an expert in this, but the whole thing around quantum mechanics, sure, like the things that they're discovering on a quantum level are going to blow our minds in the future. I mean, just in the sense of the hypothesis of the multiverse, like the idea of the multiverse makes ghosts look like nothing.
Maybe. Let's come back and continue this, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure.
Okay. And we're back with Ghost Guide Daniel. Somehow this turned into a skeptic versus a believer of ghost debate, which is spirited and fun. And as yet, I think we're hearing each other's points pretty well. Daniel, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks.
So we were talking about quantum mechanics, which I am not smart enough to understand in the slightest.
Me neither.
I like to say quark and general and special relativity, and everyone's like, oh, he knows what I'm talking about. My uncle actually had a copy of Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time on his coffee table with like bookmarks in it, and he kept it on his coffee table for 20 years because I think he wanted people to think he was smart. you know, that's my level of knowledge, but we were talking about evidence for ghosts and evidence for generally things that were unknown. And you were saying how there may be things that come to light in science that blow our minds, that make ghosts seem like not that exciting. I would even argue there's things like that today, you know?
Yes.
I guess it depends how you get your mind blown. You know, what we do know and what we have discovered and what we are discovering is mind blowing, you know, and I don't know. People are very quick to say paranormal claims are the mind-blowing things rather than like what we're getting out of the James Webb telescope or what we get out of CERN, the particle accelerator. For me, those things are mind-blowing. I can look up at the stars and be like, wow, we are a part of something huge and amazing, you know? I guess I don't really have a point here. It's just a stream of consciousness musing. But
yeah, I mean, you got an absolute point. And I always say this as well, is if you looked at reality as if you were brand new to it, it would blow your mind much more than the idea of ghosts. Like I always say to people, they're like, oh, I don't believe in ghosts. You're psycho for believing it. But I say, just think about it. You're standing right now on a rock that's floating in the middle of supposed, at least what we can see, endless space. And we have no idea why. Like that, and ghosts are where you draw the line. Like it's well, just reality in general is insane.
I agree, but for me, like that's enough. Like we have evidence that we're on this rock hurling into space, and all the crazy things that are out there. And when we look with a microscope, and all the crazy mathematics we've discovered, and physics, and you know, I guess it comes back to like untestable claims. But we were talking about how you can kind of test some of these claims with infrared equipment. What would be some of the evidence that kind of, or is that not particularly strong? You were just mentioning it.
Well, I mean, it's not the strongest ever, but the more and more tools that come out, these things can improve. And I will admit that a lot of the people who are into ghosts sometimes take it a little bit too far, like they're believers over everything else.
Sure.
Hey, you gotta stay in the middle. I think everything in life, you always got to stay in the middle. Just keep an open mind and be willing to learn. Like infrared cameras for picking up hot and cold in an empty room. You have your audio recordings, as long as it's a really well-controlled environment. And then if some sound comes in, that could be a recognizable voice saying something. And just pictures in general, I'm not a believer in the orb photos. There's just like too much natural phenomenon, like moisture and dust that can cause them. However, I have seen photos where you can see like figures, and not like misty figures, but actual figures that appear and then shouldn't be there. So, I mean, there's extremes on both sides. And again, you just got to always approach it with a skeptical mind.
But wouldn't, see, I guess as a skeptic, it's for me, it's kind of like extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Like Daniel, if you told me you went to the store this morning, I would believe it. It's also not that important if you're lying, you know, but that's kind of if my girlfriend tells me like, oh, I got more milk, I don't need to open the fridge and weigh the milk and test the pH. But if someone says, okay, you know, if someone handed me a copy of Dianetics and said, okay, you need to believe in Scientology now, I'd be like, actually, I need a little more evidence that L. Ron Hubbard's claims are true. You know, like I don't, you know, I mean, Battlefield Earth, great. Great book, but no, I didn't actually read it. But yeah, I just, and so when you say, okay, there's a photograph, well, to me, it's like those can be manipulated. There also could be like atmospheric cosmic rays causing the film to, there could be any wild reason why this would happen. I'm also okay saying, I don't know. Like just because there's a photograph that appears to be a ghost, like that, I need to know more about like the mechanism of how it got there and, you know, the, like all these, like I you'd have to, there's pictures of Bigfoot, I guess I'll go back to. This is where my mind goes. So I'm just wondering how we come to a, go ahead.
It's so true. I mean, but you can say that about pretty much anything. Like if you say that we've proven something scientifically, well, then there's like, there's 100 reports that say it's proven and 100 reports that say it hasn't been proven. You know, as sometimes at a certain point, it's just guessing and you don't know 100%. So I think it comes down, of course, to the person's mm-hmm. belief. And for me, I'm like, I really don't have a huge motivation to believe in ghosts. Because my entire life is based around telling history and it's related spirits of experiences that happened to other people. I mean, it helps that I've had experiences as well, but I don't need them to do my job and to be a tour guide. So this is really just a personal interest.
That's actually very interesting. As much as you're into ghost tours and stuff, what you do and who you are doesn't actually predicate on their existence. It's more about the history, other people's stories, what's been told about these places. I mean,
yeah, it's like the guy who tells everybody to smoke cigarettes and you find out that they're being paid off by the cigarette company. It's like, I don't need to believe in ghosts.
Wait, the big ghost lobby is funding you?
Yes, I'm part of Big Ghost.
Okay, so I get that. And I find these things fun. Like I would go on a ghost tour. I believe that people have sincerely held beliefs about these things. And I would even go as far to say, as I'm not making the claim this stuff isn't real. I just, for me, like I would need extreme evidence to accept it as true. Having said that, from the history angle, like to me, it's fascinating. And that's why some of these like ghost TV shows, and they don't actually require belief in it. You know, it's about so much more. It's about the human stories behind this stuff.
And I find that with the ghost shows, I'm not a huge fan of them. For the most part, I don't watch them because I've been involved with some of them. And I know that not all of them, but a lot of them will fake stuff, calling it dramatizations,
sure.
But, you know, passing it off as real. But yeah, the idea that the history they present, I'm 100% on for, but the shows that just focus on them walking around with the tools waiting for stuff to happen, and then in turn probably faking the things that do, I'm not a huge fan. So it always comes down to a base of history for me.
Cool. I totally feel that. I used to work in Silicon Valley, like in the tech industry, and that HBO comedy show, Silicon Valley, I could not and still cannot watch it. It's just too close to the home. It's too close to home. Like all those cheesy archetypes and stereotypes and half-truths that are told on that show, they're all based in reality. And it's like, I can't do it. Do you have that same experience when you're watching Ghost TV? You're like, I live this, I breathe this, I teach this, I know the history of this, these shows, I can't do it. It's too close to home.
Well, it's basically it. And then I guess I'm jaded because I just assume they're faking everything. But it's similar to that.
I like that. I feel like you and I are more similar than not in terms of the skeptic's mindset.
For sure.
Which is surprising to me. And I'm glad we discussed this because I feel like when you talk to people that hold very different views, you'll find out you have more in common with them than not, unless they're like serial killers. But I haven't interviewed a serial killer. I can say
confidently, I am not one of, I'm not a serial killer.
But you would say that if you were one. We're just saying. And
if we weren't on video, I would have winked after that.
I would also claim I'm not a serial. I mean, or maybe it'd be a good trick to tell everyone I'm a serial killer and everyone thinks you're joking. And then when they find out it's true, they're like, well, it's like, we can't say he didn't warn us.
Yeah, he was being honest the whole time, so.
All right. So tell me about the Ghost Guy. Tell me about the podcast. Where can people find out more about you?
Ghostwalks.com, Hamilton, Niagara, and Kitchener area tours that are going all the time. And I do a podcast very simply called Ghost Guy Daniel Podcast.
Every other Wednesday.
Every other Wednesday, but I'm going to start doing smaller shows as well, just about like specific ghost and history experiences.
Cool. What's your favorite story that you've told on your podcast?
Well, definitely the Merritt House one gets on the top of the list, but I've talked about so much over the years. Most recently, I shared a story of a haunted place in Hamilton called the Custom House, and so many things happened there, but there was one time that one of our tour guides was terrified. He saw the shadow of a woman appear in front of him while he was waiting to start the tour, and it freaked him out. He thought it was the coordinator, but then it rose like it was coming towards him, and then faded away. The talking about the Custom House is definitely a highlight.
Okay, and favorite ghost of all time in all countries across this whole planet, or maybe on another planet, but probably on this planet. Who's your favorite ghost?
You say like Zip Zorp from Mars is my favorite. No,
Zorp from Mars. Great ghost. 10 out of 10.
Well, I mentioned the woman at the Custom House is a ghost known as the Dark Lady. And there was a poem supposedly written about her back in the 1800s. So we have an extremely historic ghost that exists, definitely on the top of my list. And the one of the tour locations we do at the ruins in the middle of the forests of Ancaster, which is also part of Hamilton. And there's a spirit out there that's a legend known as William Black. So these stories, they're so rich and robust, definitely top my list.
All right. William Black and Zorp from Mars. Daniel, thank you for being on the show. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, David.
That's a wrap. Happy Friday. I got to run. I'm about to make lamb bolognese, and we'll be back on Monday with more of the Siemens Alive with Tony Five and also whatever the hell this show is, because I really don't have any idea. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you for listening. And thank you, as is quoted in the scripture, for being a friend. The Golden Girls is scripture in this case, because you know the theme song is Thank You for Being a Friend.